Little Rockin' Robin to get us going on the show today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. You know, that was a song that was written by humans, and today we're going to talk about birds and their love songs with two guests. One of them, lucky to have Rebecca Heisman with us today. She's a science writer, author of the book Flight Paths, How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration. Her words have also appeared in the Audubon Magazine, Sierra Magazine, and a whole lot more. And she's with us from Eastern Washington. Welcome, Rebecca. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
With us as well, Lynn Barber, Vice President of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Lynn's lived all around the U.S., but calls Wausau home. She's the author of three books, Extreme Birder, One Woman's Big Year, Big Years, Biggest States, Birding in Texas and Alaska, and also Birds in Trouble. So, Lynn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So as you listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in. Are you a bird watcher? Let us know what you wonder about birds' mating behavior, or maybe an unusual call you've heard. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, you both have experienced a lot of it, bird watching, and as you look for birds, how much do you use your ears in addition to your eyes? Rebecca, I'll start with you.
Quite a lot. I'm definitely nowhere near as good an ear birder, as it's called, as a lot of people I know. I'm still learning, but it's often the first hint that there's an interesting bird around is hearing a song or call. Even if you're not sure at first what it is, sometimes you just know it's something different and worth looking for.
And Lynn, I know you've written a book about your big year, which I'm pretty sure you spend a lot of time listening as well as watching.
That's very true. Many years ago, people didn't believe that you could sort of count a bird as something that you had found or seen unless you saw it. But more and more, people are realizing that if you are good at it and pay attention and try not to be confused by it, birds have very distinctive songs. And it's many days when I go looking for birds, most of the birds that are on my list for the day are birds I only heard.
Well, they make a variety of sounds. They actually have a wide variety, I think, more than the chirping we hear, for sure, Lynn.
That's correct. Most birds have songs that they sing when they're trying to show every other bird that this is their territory, and that song may be very different from the song that they sing when they're trying to woo a mate. And they have other little songs when they're feeding or, you know, just or yelling at a squirrel or something like that. So
we have a bird call and we have a bird song. Rebecca, what's the difference?
There's not really a universally accepted definition for these things, but usually when we talk about a bird song, we're talking about what Lynn was talking about, these beautiful sounds that they produce to defend territories and attract mates. And when we talk about a bird call, that's those little chirps that you referred to, and that's more used for quick, simple communication with other birds, like just signaling, hey, I'm here, or warning other birds of danger, things like that.
So scientists, though, Rebecca, think we should separate those bird vocalizations into those two categories, and I'm wondering why would that be?
Well, for birds that do have these really clearly defined songs that are very different from their calls, these different vocalizations, like I was just talking about, serve very different purposes in the birds' lives. And so we want to study, like, how are they producing these different sounds and what are these different sounds used for?
What parts of a bird's anatomy allow them to vocalize?
Yeah, so in humans, our vocal organ is called the larynx. That's the technical term for our voice box. The equivalent in birds is called the syrinx, but it's a little bit different from our larynx. It's located further down in their throat. So it's right when their windpipe kind of branches to go to their lungs. And because it's right where this, you know, tube sort of branches, it has two sides, and they can actually control the two sides of it independently to make more than one note at the same time, which is how they're able to produce such complicated, beautiful songs.
Yeah, boy, it's really fun to hear, really fun to hear. Well,
yeah.
And they use songs and calls during mating season. And we'll be hearing some songs today. Trina's got some loaded up for us. So I'm looking forward to hearing them. First, let's hear from a couple of common Wisconsin birds as they woo their mates. It's one of my favorite birds, as a matter of fact. Let's listen to A Courting Pair of Northern Cardinals.
I knew Cardinal would come first.
Wow, Lynn, they're excited.
They are. And the really the weird thing is, this isn't necessarily right on the topic to today, but when I grew up in Wausau, cardinals were nowhere around here. They did not come this far north at all. And now, you know, they're here. They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're my favorite. I do a little jog every morning, right at just a little before sunrise. And as sunrise is coming along, I think we have a cardinal in every block in our city, or more than one. And
they actually are one of the few bird species that is known that both the male and the female will sing. In many other species, the male is the singer and the female is, you know, standing by.
So what makes a mating song more or perhaps less attractive to a prospective mate? Rebecca?
Well,
yeah, go ahead, Rebecca. Yeah. Start with you and then we'll go to Lynn.
Yeah, so birds are picking up on things that we don't necessarily hear. People who study how birds listen to and evaluate each other's songs have found that they're picking up on all sorts of little fine scale variations in volume and pitch that we don't even register, and that encodes a lot of information about the singer's sex and age and health and things like that. And also Lynn noted that in the cardinals, both the male and female sing. That is absolutely true. I think we often think of bird song as being something that the male birds do to sort of woo the females, but female song has actually been documented in about 70% of songbird species now, and so that's a very active area of research.
Trina, can we get that once more? Let's listen to that once more. Oh, boy. So much fun to listen to. I love it. Well, so that's the cardinal. We have the piping calls of a blue jay courting group. And first, what's a courting group before we hear it?
Blue jays are one of the birds that whole family groups stay together much of the year. And they isn't just mommy and daddy, but it's, you know, aunt and uncle and kids from previous generations. So.
All right, well, here we go. Let's listen. I hear some click, click, click in there, too. Is that from the blue jay as well?
Yeah, yes. They can do a lot. They can imitate a lot of other birds as well as just make their own sounds.
So it's interesting that there's the whole family. So what are they sharing about themselves when they're singing for a mate? What's the blue jay or any other bird, you know, what are they kind of sharing about themselves?
Oh, I think part of it's just the territory. Here's home. Here's where we're going to set up home if you come and join me.
Yeah. Rebecca?
Yep. Yeah, here I am. And also, the better their song, they're also just showing that they're, you know, healthy and vigorous and a good prospect for a bird that's looking for a co-parent.
Linda in Edgerton emailed us a photo of a male and a female cardinal. seemingly kissing, and this certainly looks like it, at a bird feeder. Is that a behavior that's common?
Lynn, do you want to take that?
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of birds that sort of look like they're, like pigeons and things, for example, are well known to bill and coo, you know. But most birds, I mean, they might, one of the pair might be holding a piece of seed that the other one is trying to pick up, or they're off. Some birds offer food to the other bird. I don't know about cardinals per se, but so I don't know.
It might be, well, it seems affectionate, but that's, right, of course, to me.
Or, I think affection is hard to define in birds,
yeah,
or other animals, really.
Yeah, you're right. Jamie in Algoma has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. We were down on the beach the other day, and all we could see were mallards. And we kept hearing this real high-pitched peep, peep noise, and we're, what on earth is that? That's not a mallard. Mallards quack. And I pulled up my Merlin app and had it, I went through all the different sounds that a mallard can make, and sure enough, that was a display sound for a mallard. So I wanted to bring up the mallard display sound and the Merlin app that's so helpful to identify birds at different times of year.
Actually, go ahead.
The Merlin app is great. I just said the Merlin app is great, and I grew up with my parents raising mallards, and I learned early on that the male mallard does not know how to quack. That's the mama
that's right.
Does the quacking.
The mom does the quacking. Okay.
Yeah, the classic quack, quack, quack is just the females.
So let's hear some male courtship whistles from the mallard. Trina, you got that up?
Yes, Mama caught quacking to him as he's making his sound.
Well, other birds, mallards choose a mate per season, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Well, actually, the males are sort of, everybody mates with everybody, and the males mate with as many females as they can find.
But you usually, you know, Rebecca, at least in my observations, as I run along Lake Monona here in Madison, or any place else for that matter, there's usually a male, and one male and one female together. And it looks like they've been together for a while because they're making a nest or something, or they're going to a nest.
I mean, Lynn's right. Ducks are known for being pretty promiscuous.
Yeah, and you will see, I notice on many occasions, one poor mallard hen is being chased.
By many males.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, sometimes it looks like the female is going to be drowned because they're seriously vigorous about the whole process.
We're talking today with our two guests today, Lynn Barber, a vice president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Rebecca Heisman, science writer and editor and author, I should say, about birds and their love songs. If you want to join in, the number to call 800-642-1234. You could email us. The email address ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert, our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking birds and their love songs on the show today with Lynn Barber, vice president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Rebecca Heisman, science writer and author of the book Flight Paths, How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration. And I haven't read that book, but I got to get a copy because it sounds pretty interesting to me. She, by the way, Rebecca's in Eastern Washington, lives in Eastern Washington. So great to have her with us. And again, call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Just before we go back to the phones, let's talk about this mating for life business from a survival standpoint. Mating for life does benefit some birds, and not others, obviously, as we've seen here with the mallards. Lynn, you want to comment? Maybe Rebecca, too. Lynn, start with you.
Okay, well, I happen to be writing a book about owls right now, and I'm learning a lot of things about owls, of course, as I do all this research. But one of the things I learned is that some owls do mate for life, and other owls, and I learned that the snowy owl, for example, quite often the males will remain up north or farther north, and the females might come farther south. And so he waits around for her to come back, and quite often the same one will come back to the same male. And so they may not stay together every minute of the year, but they might come back together.
Yeah.
Others start over again every year, new with a different mate or whoever comes, whoever they come upon.
Rebecca, a comment at all? I've heard
I mean, there's about 10,000 species of bird in the world, and they're hugely diverse, including their mating systems. So, yeah, you've got everything from birds that pair up for life and typically remain together until one of them dies, to birds that have what's called a lekking system, where the males all get together in one spot to do their displays, and the females come watch and pick the best one to mate with, and then the male's contribution is done, and the female goes off and does all the work herself. So it's a whole range.
A whole range. Back as I can remember, just as a kid being told that Canada geese mated for life, and I'm not even sure if that's true, but part of it had to do with the short time mating time period, a short amount of time and so you needed to have somebody with you when the proper time came along. Is that a total falsehood, Lynn or Rebecca?
I'm not sure about Canada geese. I expect that they don't mate for life, but I don't actually know that.
Yeah.
Rebecca?
Yeah, I don't know either. I know that a lot of there might be something to that, because some of these like lekking songbirds that get together and do these amazing displays live in the tropics, where they have, you know, they can basically breed year round if they want to. So there might be something to that.
Yeah. Todd, who's on Madison's east side, let's go to you. Hi, Todd.
Hey, love your show. I'm not sure if this is about birds that mate for life, but I do have two my favorite birds I wanted to talk about. I think the red-tailed hawk falls into that category. Not sure, but more importantly, another thing that maybe you could help me out with, one of you two. My favorite songbird is the white-throated sparrow, and I know it doesn't stick around southern Wisconsin real long, like a month, month and a half, but I heard one about 2 weeks ago, which was super early for this time of year, and I just absolutely love the white-throated sparrow and the songs and the singing that it does. And I'll hang up. And you guys are awesome, and your show is super. Thank you.
All right, Todd, thank you so much. Well, because Todd's talking about Wisconsin sort of in general, I'll go to Lynn for this. Lynn, comment?
I really don't know about white-throated sparrows, whether they mate for life, but I do know that at various places in Wisconsin, especially if somebody's been throwing out a few bits of seed on the ground regularly, some of the sparrows, the white crowned, will stick around all winter long if there's food. And I think it's happening more and more nowadays. But yes, and since we're having such a mild winter, as long as they can find food and they, you know, they have no reason to be scared away, a lot of birds are staying around that normally wouldn't.
Yeah, and you're nodding in agreement there, Rebecca.
Yeah, white-throated sparrows don't migrate super far, so they're definitely a bird that it wouldn't be surprising to see stick around somewhere like Wisconsin through the winter, depending on conditions. We even get them here in the winter sometimes, even where I live in Washington State, even though this is supposed to be outside their range if you look at a map.
They're there. Okay. Sally in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Thanks so much. I was ignorant about bird bath. Well, I knew what it was, of course, until I moved into my house, and right outside my kitchen window was a bird bath. It was there, and it wasn't a feeder. I know all about feeders, but so it was surprising to see the interaction between bird to bird. around that bird bath. They would never go. Two was not permitted. They would go in one at a time, and the other one would have to watch until that bass bather was flew away, and then they would go in, and they would sometimes threaten each other. They wouldn't go in together. They never went in together, but they would stand on the rim and kind of threaten each other until the one flew away. In other words, they really, really enjoyed the bath, and they would not go in together. They would take turns up to the point of threatening to, the bigger bird to threaten the little one. But it was just a wonderful show out my window. If you ever had it, if anybody wanted to have an ongoing close-up view of bird interactions and their beauty, their feathers and their beauty.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for calling. Rebecca, maybe a comment from you, and then we'll go to Sally.
Yeah, bird baths are a lot of fun. If you want to attract even more birds to your bird bath, if you have a way of setting up something so that there's some movement in the water, like some drops falling into it or something, that even more attracts birds.
Yeah. Lynn, a comment?
Yeah, I lived in Texas for 10 years and had made myself a little bog and some bog plants, and then I had dripping water running into the – it was all quite complicated. But I got birds coming to my little bog and to my dripping water that I never saw at all in my yard except right there. And usually in the fall during migration, they were all thirsty and it was getting dry and they'd stop in my yard. Bird baths are spectacular to have. And in Wisconsin, you can have a heater in the – I have one right now of a heater keeping a bird bath not frozen.
Yeah, and open. And I've noticed in my bird bath, too, I guess I'd have to agree with Sally. You're not going to, at least in my bird bath, you're not going to see more than one at a time, but you will see a couple even hanging around the edge while one finishes up.
Some species, however, will come all at once, like cedar waxwings and sometimes robins. They'll just, like, descend upon a bird bath, and they'll all be there at once. So they don't all fight all the time.
Well, speaking of all at once, Mike in Madison has a question about maybe not bathing all at once, but something else. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Wonderful show. I noticed over the years water birds to be large groups of them, maybe 100, and then all of a sudden 20 or 25 will take off and fly off away. And I often thought to myself, why did those particular 25 go at the same time? Are they related? Is there a social contract between different groups? What makes
them all get up and go at the same time? Mike, you're breaking up a little bit, but thank you for that question. Rebecca, do you want to take a chance? And then we can go to Lynn.
I'm not sure I know the answer. That's a great observation of bird behavior, but it's hard to know what's going on in their heads when some of them take off and leave and some of them don't.
Yeah, but a bunch taking off at the same time is not unusual at all, is it, Lynn?
No, and it happens in little birds, too. I happen to have flocks of pine siskins right now coming to my yard, and they'll all be feeding around like mad, and all of a sudden, like 30 of the 50 will go skittering away, and the rest are just like don't even look up. And so I'm not sure if it's just dumber ones or more frantic birds. You know, maybe they're just different personality types. I don't know.
I would think, there may be something going on that when a large group and when they take off in a large group, it's you have a less of a chance of getting picked off by one of those red-tailed hawks an earlier caller.
That's true. Flocking, for sure. And starlings are a good example of that. They hang together, and it's hard. You know, any one starling is a pretty good chance of surviving in that huge flock, even if there's a hawk around.
You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Well, our state bird is the robin, and we have some different vocalizations for the American robin. And first, one of their common calls, Trina, have you got one of those common calls?
Thank you.
You're going to hear that a lot in the state of Wisconsin, probably in the state of Washington, too.
Yeah.
What purpose does the robin's call serve like that?
Well, what we just heard is what would be considered the robin's song. So that's what they're singing to defend their territory and attract a mate.
Okay, well, here's another one. This one's called a chirr. Yeah. Lynn, what about that one?
That one's warning away. That's like, oh, my God, there's something horrible happening around here.
Well,
the first one to me, we always called that when I was growing up. We called it the Robin's Rain Song. I have no idea. We thought it was going to rain. But when I hear it, it sounds to me like it's afternoon and the Robin is singing that song and and we're thinking it's going to rain. I don't know.
Well, I like that story, though. I like that. Well, let's see. What have we got next? We've got the Chuck, I believe. Let's listen to the Robin Chuck. Yeah, now that sounds like a warning to me. Am I right on that, Rebecca?
I don't know all the different robin calls when you get outside the song. Maybe Lynn knows.
Lynn, it sounds like...
I'm guessing that it's another one that it's saying, hey, so, you know, it's sort of an attention thing, like something's going on here. You know, maybe there's, you know, maybe they're mad at something, maybe they're scared of something. I don't think I don't think it's particularly territorial so much as just an alarm, sort of.
Okay. And I'm told that robins can even warn each other about the location of predators. I don't know if you've heard that, but I think Trina's got a call that relates to the sea call, I think it's called. It's a good description, sea call, for sure. What do you think, Lynn?
Afraid I don't know.
Rebecca, any idea?
I think that's the one they use specifically when there's a hawk flying overhead. So that's like there's danger from above.
Oh, the sea.
Okay, that sounds right.
Yeah. Okay. So, so a bird's. Well, let me put it this way. How does a bird's location affect how it calls or sings?
I mean, it is something they keep in mind because when they're singing specifically, so when they're doing this territorial song to warn away rivals and attract mates, they want that to carry really far. So they'll pick a perch, a spot to sit where people are going to, or not people, but other birds are going to be able to hear them from all around.
It's pretty cool. And I'm wondering, all right, you got a young bird, a baby bird or whatever, and it's just growing up. How do they learn those songs?
Yeah, so songbirds are usually learning those songs from their parents. And when we talk about songbirds, so like a bird scientist, this is a specific group of birds that are also called the passeriformes, the perching birds. And so usually these are the birds that have these really well-developed, beautiful musical songs. Hawks and ducks and shorebirds, they have interesting vocalizations, but they're not songbirds. But so these songbirds specifically are listening to their parents or to other adult birds around them, and they actually learn their songs by listening. They're not just born knowing them. And because of that, you can even get regional dialects with songs that vary from place to place being passed down through the generations.
So there.
Also, sometimes it gets messed up, though, because years ago, I heard in northern Wisconsin, I heard a bird that should not be there. And I was like really excited. And when I finally found the bird singing, it was singing a different warbler song.
Yeah.
It was a Nashville warbler singing a Prothonotary warbler song. So.
Trying to fool you.
Well, I think it was just a mixed up bird. Maybe I have no idea how it got there.
Well, this, you know, I mentioned earlier that I love running in the early morning. I get up here, I get out about 5:30, quarter to 6 in the morning, and go on a jog through the neighborhood, and I get to go along a lake, and it's fun. And that dawn chorus, I love it in the spring. And I think that's what ornithologists call it, dawn chorus, the early morning when the birds do most of their singing. Why do we understand why birds love to sing in the earliest hours of the day, Rebecca?
We don't know for sure. It's true. Birdsong begins around maybe 4 a.m. and then peaks around sunrise. There's some theories. Maybe it's too dark that early to be a good time of day for foraging, so they make good use of that time by singing instead. Or maybe it's sort of a warm-up session to help birds ensure that their song the rest of the day is going to be as good as it can be. But my understanding is that ornithologists don't know exactly why the dawn chorus happens when it happens. Maybe Lynn knows something about this.
Lynn?
I don't know anything at all. The only comment at all I would say about the dawn chorus is that I've been involved in breeding bird surveys, and you're supposed to be out there at that time birding and figuring out how many birds there are on your route that you're doing. And it's awful, because they are all singing and like, who's that? Where, you know, they do not take turns.
Yeah, a long time ago, I spent a summer doing bird surveys up in Saskatchewan, and to be at my first point where I was supposed to count birds by the time the sun rose in summer in Saskatchewan, right. I had to get up at 3:30 in the morning.
Oh my gosh. I love Saskatchewan. Yep. And I've heard those birds in the early morning, and it's a different, obviously a different group from what I'm hearing in Wisconsin, or at least, yeah, for the most part. So it's always kind of fun to hear the different songs and the differences between the female and the male. And I guess scientists have overlooked female bird songs, Rebecca, a bit.
Yeah, part of that is because a lot of the songbirds where females sing are in the tropics, and tropical songbirds have not been as well studied historically as the birds in Europe and North America. But I mentioned this earlier, we think now that about 70% of songbird species, so that specific group of birds that I was talking about, and about 70% of them, the females do sing as well as the males. And now they think, looking at the songbird family tree, that probably females sang in the common ancestor of all songbirds. So the bigger question might be, why don't females sing in some species?
Interesting. Lynn, how can a beginning bird watcher in Wisconsin learn more and get involved with the community?
That's a nice question for me. join the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology as a starter. But even actually more importantly, find out if there's a local bird group around where you are. And there are many. Most of them, I'm sure all of them, welcome new birders and are happy to have people come along with them and listen and hear and find. I mean, when I started birding, I learned I was on my own. But then I went to Madison as a undergrad and started birding with some other people and realized how much I could learn by just being around people who knew a lot more than I did. But nowadays we also have bird apps, and bird apps are spectacular. Merlin was mentioned. Merlin is very good. It's not a total savior of things because it can error. But it will tell you what bird you're hearing with quite a bit of accuracy, I should say. Take it with a grain of salt sometimes. But.
And the Wisconsin's, what would someone gain from being a member of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology?
I think the main thing would be less of a personal gain as far as getting something right this minute as a reward, but knowing you're helping support the enjoyment, the study, the bird conservation in the state, because the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology is doing a lot of work to try to, make things better for birds and help all of us understand birds better. Membership, means you're helping support something good.
Yeah, I think that's, Rebecca, are you a member of any birding organizations?
Yeah, I'm a member of the local Audubon chapter where I live in Walla Walla, Washington, the Blue Mountain Audubon. So, yeah, it's a great way just to meet other people who are interested in birds.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. You had an article.
Most of them have,
Go ahead, Lynn.
I was going to say most of them have programs, too, not only going birding with these people, but you know, sitting and watching their programs and learning from people talking to you about bird things.
Yeah, I've been on a few excursions, bird watching excursions, with some really good expert who could instantly, it felt like, identify a bird's song and then a lot of times point that bird out, even if the group of us couldn't quite see it at first, he or she would be able to point it out to us. It really a lot of fun. Rebecca, you also you had an article on this, and you included in your article the song, which is kind of stirring, I think, of the South American music wren, and I think Trina's got that up. Let's listen to the music, musician wren. Musician wren is the name of the bird. I'm sorry, musician wren. Let's hear that. Boy, that's really pretty. Kind of a good way to go out. Do you like that bird, Rebecca?
Yeah, it's one that lives in the Amazon in South America, and some people consider it to have one of the most complex and beautiful bird songs in the world. So it's a great ending note.
Yeah, isn't that a good way to end, isn't it, Lynn?
Excellent, excellent. The only thing it did remind me of some of our thrushes. So we do have some pretty good singers up here, too.
we do indeed. Boy, this has been a lot of fun. Lynn, Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us on this Valentine's Day to talk about birds and their love songs and some other things about birds, too. It's been a real pleasure. I hope we can do it again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Lynn Barber is Vice President of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Lived all over the country, the U.S., but calls Wisconsin home. And Rebecca Heisman, science writer and author of the book, which I'm going to get a copy of, Flight Paths, How a Passionate and Quirky Group of Pioneering Scientists Solved the Mystery of Bird Migration. She lives in Eastern Washington. Pleasure to have both of them with us, and maybe we can do it again with them. But we're going to turn now to the Milwaukee Public Zoo and take a look at its breeding program. That next with our guest, Tracy Dolphin. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.